I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Before he was elected to Congress, Brian Fitzpatrick worked for the FBI, and one of his jobs was to help establish the National Anti-Corruption Bureau in Ukraine, where he trained prosecutors and investigators. This was 2015, a critical time for the country. Well, Ukraine is back in the news after President Trump's phone call this summer with the newly elected President Zelensky. Their conversation is the subject of a whistleblower complaint that President Trump pressured Zelensky to investigate Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, who had sat on the board of a Ukrainian gas company. And one of the questions at the heart of this controversy involves former Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin, who was supposed to root out corruption. Biden and others had called for his ouster. Brian Fitzpatrick is a Republican elected in 2016 representing Pennsylvania's 1st Congressional District. And Brian Fitzpatrick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, how are you?
Good. What was your job in 2015? You were there for something like 4 months.
Yeah, between 3 and 4 months. And it was a detail, one of many that I took as an FBI agent. This one was with the International Corruption Unit to help Ukraine post Yuri Maidan Revolution after the ouster of Viktor Yanukovych. Obviously, the country was in a rebuilding phase. Corruption has, historically been a systemic issue in that region. I worked, obviously, a lot of corruption cases here in the United States as an FBI agent. So I got sent out there to give them a hand and help them set up what was known as the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, which was designed as the Poroshenko administration came in, designed to weed out high-level corruption in that country.
And what specifically were your responsibilities, or how were you training these investigators, these prosecutors?
Well, it was one facet of it. We trained them on best practices based on, my investigative experiences in FBI. Obviously, we have a different set of rules and regulations governing our investigative conduct here in the United States than they do overseas. But, explaining to them how to, conduct undercover operations, how to recruit sources. Obviously, Title III's are the U.S. Version of criminal wiretaps, FISA wiretaps, national security things and the like.
Now, Viktor Shokin, who is very much in the news in the last week or so, was the prosecutor general, kind of like the attorney general, from February 2015 to March 2016, when he was essentially ousted from office. Did you have dealings with him particularly?
Not him specifically. Obviously, the prosecutor general's office, yes. And, that was one of the issues that we were dealing with over there. And this was a position that was fairly consistent throughout the U.S. Embassy, throughout the State Department components, as well as a lot of the other governmental agencies over there, that the prosecutor general's office was a problem. There was a lot of corruption within that entity itself. And obviously, it was believed that Mr. Shokin was part of that problem.
Did he cooperate in any way with the FBI?
Well, I didn't deal with him personally, but it was our general understanding based on the directives that we believed he was giving down to his rank and file prosecutors. We had a big challenge dealing with the PG's office. Obviously, a lot of what we do in the international corruption role requires assistance from our foreign law enforcement counterparts overseas, whether that's a U.S.-based investigation where we need to collect evidence overseas or whether that's an investigation into an oligarchy or kleptocracy or Foreign Corrupt Practice Act. So the relationships that we build overseas are very important. That was one of the reasons why the FBI embarked in missions like this, and also working with the international law enforcement academies around the world where we taught law enforcement professionals from across the globe. One of the reasons was we wanted to build these relationships. It was unfortunate that in Ukraine at that time we did not have that type of relationship with the PG's office.
The consensus was, and still is, that Viktor Shokin was not investigating corruption, he was not pushing for reforms, and that calls for him to resign came from European governments, came from groups within Ukraine, came from the Ukrainian government itself, and came from Vice President Biden and the Obama administration. Was that your assessment?
Yes, it was my assessment that some of the cases that we were trying to move were not moving. It was believed, and again, I've never met him personally, but it was the understanding of the State Department apparatus that he was one of the problems of causing a hindrance in a lot of the anti-corruption efforts over there.
President Trump in his this is the memo that came out of the White House about his conversation with President Zelensky of Ukraine, called Shokin a fair prosecutor and said, quote, Shokin was treated very badly. Do you agree with that?
Well, I can only share with you my perspective based on my experience. You know, I've never met him personally, but it was our assessment based at the level that I was operating at. In the cases that we were working, that we were not getting cooperation from the PG's office in general. Obviously, he was at the helm, so we hold him responsible, as we do people in his chain of command, for not providing the level of assistance that we were requesting, both from the FBI and the other entities.
I mean, not to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you disagree with President Trump, who said Shokin was treated very badly and was a fair prosecutor.
Yeah, I don't know what he's referencing there. I can only share with you my experiences. If there's other information that he's aware of, you know, I can give you my assessment based on my time there, that Mr. Shokin was not cooperating with us in the manner that we needed him to.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Brian Fitzpatrick, a Republican. He represents Pennsylvania's 1st Congressional District in the U.S. Congress, and I believe the only FBI agent with experience in Ukraine serving in Congress. Is that correct, Brian Fitzpatrick?
I believe I'm the only FBI agent in Congress, so I think your second part would be correct, yes.
And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One of the reasons for impeachment coming from the Democrats, coming from Nancy Pelosi, was based on this conversation that President Trump had with President Zelensky, the subject of this whistleblower's complaint, claiming pressuring Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. We should add that Joe Biden, of course, is a leading Democrat in running for the White House. Where do you stand on impeachment?
Well, it's a very serious allegation that was made that I believe we need to look into. My only objection, Marty, you know, I don't think it's a good idea, before we know the facts, to launch this inquiry in the context of an impeachment inquiry, because that's a very, very serious step to take. And I think we need to be very judicious about how we proceed. Now, is it a very serious allegation? Of course it is. Do we need to get to the bottom of it? Absolutely. But we can do this in another context. So the allegations that were made previously were investigated by my former boss, Bob Mueller. I supported that investigation. Our job as FBI agents has always been to follow the facts wherever they lead and report those facts with unimpeachable integrity. Where it becomes a problem is when it gets taken out of the law enforcement context and into the realm of politics, because then people lose confidence on the motives the motives behind the decisions being made. I think there's no question right now that this we are proceeding largely based on partisanship in politics, which is very disappointing, because this is a serious allegation. We do need to get to the bottom of it, and we need to remove politics out of the equation. And that's just not what's happening right now, unfortunately.
Well, impeachment is a political process. It's part of our Constitution, so it is certainly allowable. On the other hand, one of the arguments for impeachment and an inquiry, which is the status that we're in now, is that it allows Congress to get hands-on documents to force people to testify. And it looks as if the Trump White House is doing everything they can to stall any kind of investigation.
Well, we can subpoena those witnesses and subpoena those documents outside the context of an impeachment right out of the chute. And moreover, the concern with many of us, and believe me, I'm a lifelong FBI agent, a lifelong investigator. I'm all about nonpartisan fact-finding missions. That's what I've done my whole life. But the way we proceeded here, right from the get-go, we haven't even had a vote on the inquiry itself. And if you look at past precedent for impeachment proceedings, most recently with President Clinton in 1998, there was a vote in advance to start going down this road. We have not had that. Secondly, the Committee of Jurisdiction is supposed to be the Judiciary Committee. It's been taken out of that committee and put in the Intel Committee. So there's a lot of things going on here that are just a little bit, more than a little bit, a lot concerning to people like myself, who legitimately want to get to the bottom of this in a nonpartisan fashion, because this is really important. It's important that we get to the bottom of what the allegation is and the credibility and the corroboration of it, And also, we're setting precedents with everything we do and don't do here with regard to impeachment. And I think that that's a very, very significant, it's probably the second most significant action a member of Congress can take, second only to sending people's children into battle. It's something we need to take very seriously. We need to proceed cautiously. And that's not the sense of what myself and many of my colleagues are seeing right now.
It's being taken up by a number of committees, including intelligence. But my understanding is that intelligence is involved because it involves a foreign government.
Correct. So there can be multiple committees of jurisdiction, but the lead committee is supposed to be judiciary. So, for example, OGR is involved. Foreign Affairs is involved. That's a committee I sit on because of the State Department implications. So, of course, there should be tangential committee oversight without question. But the core committee that is supposed to be taking this up is judiciary. And moreover, not having a vote on this is setting a brand new precedent, and I believe a very dangerous precedent, to allow a speaker to launch this inquiry on her own without any vote on the floor of the House.
Let me ask you for your response, Attorney General, the Attorney General and others are, in a sense, working with foreign governments to undermine, frankly, the work of FBI and intelligence. Are you comfortable with that?
I'm sorry. One more time.
Well, the fact that the Attorney General, I'm also thinking of Secretary of State Pompeo visiting countries to get, frankly, to get dirt on some of the work of intelligence and FBI, whether you're comfortable with that.
Well, what should happen is that should be in the law enforcement context. You know, I've made this statement repeatedly. Whether or not to initiate an investigation, whether or not to close an investigation, and the conduct of an open investigation, what steps to take and not take, right, are decisions that should be made by law enforcement and law enforcement alone. They should not be made by politicians at all. And that's one of the things I've objected to with the stories that have been, or the allegations that have been made, both against the president and our previous vice president. That is not a role politicians should play. That should be left in the realm of law enforcement. These are the women and men who are professionals, who are not partisan, and who do the job of following the facts and reporting those facts with unimpeachable integrity. That's why I'm a fan of investigations, but nonpartisan law enforcement investigations.
We're almost out of time here. The president has called the whistleblower and those who have worked with him spies. Are you comfortable with that?
I don't know what he's basing that on.
But he's saying it out publicly.
Yeah, well, I'll give you my assessment that the whistleblower ought to be assumed to be credible, as he has been deemed, or she has been deemed, until proven otherwise. But we have a mission now. We have an anonymous complaint, 6 or 7 pages, based largely, if not exclusively, on hearsay. So our job is to get to the bottom of that now. And I think we need to get to the bottom of it. And I think we should leave the name calling out of it. And I think we need to leave the partisan and politics out of it. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that up until this point.
Brian Fitzpatrick, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You got it. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a Republican, represents Pennsylvania's 1st congressional district, elected in 2016, part of a series of interviews we have been doing on the impeachment inquiry. Well, we've got another guest waiting in the wings after this very short break. Julie K. Brown will join us, talk about her explosive investigation into billionaire Jeffrey Epstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Julie K. Brown received the prestigious George Polk Award for Justice Reporting earlier this year for her explosive series in the Miami Herald with Emily Michaud, Perversion of Justice, about billionaire Jeffrey Epstein. He reportedly trafficked vulnerable teenage girls and young women in Florida, New York City, and overseas, luring them into his sexual enterprise with the offer of money and opportunities. They claim he abused and raped them, forced them to have sex with wealthy and powerful men, and that he had willing accomplices. Adding insult to injury, back in 2008, Epstein got a slap on the wrist for prostitution in a non-prosecution agreement that was kept under wraps. Epstein committed suicide in August while being held in a Manhattan jail, the day after a cache of incriminating court documents was unsealed, I should add that a number of the high-profile men accused of underage sex have vehemently denied the charges. Julie K. Brown grew up in Bucks County, worked for local papers, including the Philadelphia Daily News. She's being honored by Temple University, her alma mater, this week. And Julie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on all your work and your award as well. I want to start with the death of Jeffrey Epstein, and it has been ruled a suicide, although it is under investigation. What has been the response of the women that you have talked to about him?
Well, the women feel that, first of all, you know, they have a lot of questions, as it does everybody else, about how this could have happened. He allegedly tried to do some harm to himself just weeks before he actually was found hanging in his cell. So the question was, how did he manage to get off a suicide watch, and how did he manage to do something like this, considering that they were already on notice that he could possibly do something like this? So it raises
so they have questions about his whether how he was able to actually commit suicide.
Right. And, you know, this is just another betrayal to them in some aspects. The criminal justice system failed these women from the start of this case when they were young teenagers, you know, going through the state attorney in Florida, then the federal authorities in Florida, and, you know, all the way up the line. And so here is their chance, finally, they felt, to hold him accountable and to see him face justice. And they feel that they've been robbed by that. Once again,
a judge in New York, it was late August this year, allowed a number of these women to speak in court. What did they say? And I don't know whether you talked to any of them after that, whether they felt in any way that they were at least given the chance to say something to a courtroom.
It was very, very powerful, probably one of the most powerful things I've ever seen in my long journalism career. It was powerful not only because they were able to finally first speak out, but I also was struck by how powerful it was that all these women, some of whom never had met each other, from all around really the world. There was one from who lives in Spain, another who lives in Australia. And their stories were all the same, the wow. way that he lured them in. And it was just a calculated way he did this, these crimes. And so it was extremely powerful to see these women one by one just talking about how they were really lured into this whole ring and you know, even the nature of the abuse, how they were groomed, how they were trained. It was just amazing to hear that this had all happened. And how did he get away with this for so long?
You have spent the last couple of years looking into this case, writing about this case. What unanswered questions did you have?
Well, my biggest unanswered question is, you know, why did they give him this soft plea deal? It doesn't make any sense.
This goes back to 08.
This goes back to when they started investigating him in 2006. The police did it was the Palm Beach Police Department that first investigated him, and they just did a brilliant job on this investigation. They had phone records. They got, you know, those phone messages that said, you know, we have, you know, Brittany, she's going to come after school at 3 o'clock. We have Melissa coming at 5 o'clock. I mean, there were all kinds of records and things that they had. Then they had the testimony of the girls. Right. In some cases, the girls corroborated each other because some of the girls brought each other. It was like a sex pyramid scheme. So you have all these pieces that basically fit together, but instead of going after him, and by the time they were, you know, thinking that maybe they could get an indictment going for sex trafficking, they had already been tipped off that he was not just doing this in Florida, that he was probably doing it at least in New York, if not, you know, even overseas. So the FBI knew that this was bigger than it was, but yet they quietly, you know, arranged for this plea deal, never told the victims, tried to keep it out of the media, really sealed it so that even the judge that sentenced him didn't really have a view of what it was that he had done.
And you're saying the FBI. I know that Acosta, who was labor secretary, was U.S. attorney at the time. I should add that he has resigned as secretary earlier this summer. But nonetheless, do you blame him specifically, or him and the sort of larger investigative part of the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Well, it's hard to know where his directive came from to do this. You know, there's always been a lot of conspiracy theories about who it was in Washington that perhaps pressured him to do this. But everything that I've seen so far anyway indicates to me that this was his decision. And it seems to me, at least right now with what we know, that this was a decision that he made for his own political purposes. In other words, there were a lot of people who were caught up in this. He wasn't going to – he was very – he wanted to rise in his career. He was a rising star at the time. There was no political will for him really to do this. I think he knew that there was going to be problems if he really pursued this case.
And just to make sure listeners know, we're talking about, what, 13 months in a local jail?
Yeah, in a local jail.
In a local jail. Yeah. He left almost every day to go back to his office, I guess. And the women who had accused him were left out of this whole decision-making.
They didn't know for months – until months into his jail sentence what actually had happened, because the government sealed the plea deal. They had to go to court to get it open. Can you imagine? Here you are, not even understanding what happened. This guy abused me, and he's now getting out every day with his own valet picking him up, and I don't even understand what he pleaded to. And so you have the government then going into court. They filed a lawsuit. Because this was in violation, we later found out that it was in violation of the Federal Crime Victims' Rights Act. So they file a lawsuit, and think about this. Then it gets even stranger, because the government then goes into court and argues against letting the women even see the deal. In other words, they're almost arguing on Epstein's behalf all this time. This court case lasted over a decade, and the government fought these women every step of the way.
Now, he committed suicide. It was the day after this cache of documents, something like 2,000 pages of documents. You have looked through them, and as you mentioned, you're describing the equivalent of a sexual pyramid scheme. What is the most damning thing, I guess, in this cache of documents?
Well, these documents are all pieces of a puzzle. That's the way I look at it. There were 2,000 documents. There's a lot more that are going to come out. I suggested to the Miami Herald, in the midst of doing my investigation, that one of the patterns that I saw of the breakdown in the criminal justice system in this case was also the court system. Every time someone filed a lawsuit in this case, the judges all agreed to seal everything. So it got worse and worse as the years went by, because even as more information was theoretically coming to the forefront, nobody could see it because the judges were agreeing to seal it. So this particular case in New York, which involved Virginia Giuffre, who is one of Epstein's victims, suing Epstein's partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, we were told that there was a lot of information in there. So the Herald decided to file a motion to unseal this case. And what we did get so far shows that Virginia had testified in a sworn deposition that this was a bigger sex ring, which we suspected, but this time we had more evidence of it. There were some names of some very powerful people in there. And there were also some names of other people who weren't victims, who corroborated some of this. There's a really sad deposition in there by someone who worked or who had been worked for a friend of Epstein's, who told the story about this nanny from Sweden who had been taken to his island, and he ran into her afterwards, and she was completely devastated about what had happened to her, that she essentially was raped on the island. And this man would have had no reason to tell that story in a deposition unless it happened. So there were also pieces like that. And as I said, these are a lot of pieces. It's hard to put them all together in a coherent way. But we think when the rest of the documents are released, we'll get an even better picture of what was going on.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Julie Brown. She's an investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Her series, Perversion of Justice, written with Emily Michaud about the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking of underage girls and his plea deal with U.S. prosecutors, has won a number of awards, including the George Polk Award earlier this year. She's also the executive producer of the new podcast about the case. It's called Broken, and it's produced with Adam McKay. If you want to join us, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask you about Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, she many different kinds of relationships with Jeffrey Epstein, but it seems as if she was working very closely with him in this whole sex trafficking scheme. Do we know where she is? Does anyone know where she is?
Oh, it's like Where's Waldo kind of story with her. You know, there's been so much speculation about where she could be. What I believe is that the prosecutors in New York know where she is. At least I hope they do. And I get the feeling that they've been pretty shrewd thus far. So I don't think they would have let her out of their sights. We believe she's in Europe somewhere. You know, she is the daughter of the British late British publishing magnate, Robert Maxwell, who died under suspicious circumstances many years ago. Right. She was sort of left almost penniless at the time that this happened. And that's right when she hooked up and met Jeffrey Epstein. And, you know, in the beginning, they were boyfriend and girlfriend. And, you know, she was in love with him. And I think she quickly realized that she wasn't going to be able to keep him happy because he really liked young women. And as she grew older, like with all his women, he cast them aside. She took on the role of allegedly helping him orchestrate his sex life.
And essentially luring these girls, teenage girls and young women to his house for quote unquote massages.
Right. She we know Virginia said, and actually there's a corroborating witness that said that Ghislaine went to actually Mar-a-Lago, President Trump's summer or winter White House, and Virginia was working there at the time. She was 16, almost
Virginia
17.
Giffray. Yeah.
Yeah, she was 16, almost 17, and it was Ghislaine that recruited her. And Ghislaine at the time, we have a testimony that this driver for Epstein was taking Ghislaine to a bunch of spas, not just Mar-a-Lago, and trying to recruit young women to come on the, you know, idea that they were going to become massage therapists. He used that line an awful lot.
And in many cases, these women say what started out as a massage became forced sex, rape in some cases, certainly sexual assault. How, though, was Ghislaine Maxwell, how was she able to sort of target these vulnerable young women, these young girls, these teenage girls? Because it seems in many ways, some of them were homeless, some of them had problems at home, some of them had neglectful parents. How were they able to kind of size up who would be a target?
Well, she was, as Virginia has described it to me, is she was very prim and proper British woman who was very motherly to them. So, you know, if you come from that kind of a background, you know, myself, I had that kind of a background. Someone like that comes to you and acts like they want to help you and take care of you. And that's all you're looking for at that point in your life, because you're sort of like on a life raft and you don't know really what you're going to do with your life. And you don't have anybody to talk to really about your ambitions, your goals, your dreams, nothing. You have no prospect to go to college, you know. So she was able to come across as someone who was going to take care of them. And to some degree, she did in a way, but in a very, you know, insidious way, because that's how they groomed these girls, by sort of they never went and, you know, brought them to the house and right away, rarely did they right away rape them, but they groomed them into believing this is, you know, they would only take it as far as the girl was willing to go, and then they might back off a little bit. But then the girl got money. So then the girl was thinking, oh, if I just do this a little bit longer, I'll be able to get an apartment and I'll be able to get off the street. And so that's kind of how it happened.
You referenced yourself, and I was reading a bit about you, Julie Brown, and you left home when you were 16. So part of your own history probably dovetails with some of the girls, now women, that you have talked to about this story.
Yeah. I mean, I was pretty strong, and I had strong friends around me, fortunately, you know, and I've had a best friend for many, many years who really has been there for me. But the key is, you know, I was able to not fall down a trap like that. But I could have very easily done that. So I can kind of relate to it, because there's been times in my life that I felt like I was going to fall off a cliff and I didn't know how I was going to make it out. So I do understand that.
Do you think that's why these young women opened up to you about what happened to them?
I think so. I didn't really talk about that to them at all when I did it, but
I don't think you have to.
No. And also, here, the other thing is, this case, you know, plenty of journalists had covered this case, but I was the first journalist to really get a bunch of these women to talk. And my approach also to the project was different, and this is why I was able to convince some people to talk who hadn't talked previously. I wasn't interested in the sex part of it per se. Epstein never denied that he did this, so I didn't have to do that part of it. These were all,
in fact, his defense, as it was that he didn't think they were teenagers,
right? Which is not a defense at all, and really he did, because he was having his driver pick them up at the high school and deliver flowers to the high school and things like that. But the point is, my story was about the breakdown of the criminal justice system. And as long as I sort of kept that focus on that, the women, and I explained to the women, look, if you want to talk about the sexual abuse part of it, you can, but you don't have to talk about it with me. That's not really what I'm talking about here. We all pretty much know that you're one of the victims, because the FBI did do a list. And there were some lawsuits. They successfully sued him, some of them. So that wasn't an issue. What I thought hadn't been sufficiently investigated was exactly the analytics of exactly how the criminal justice system mishandled this case.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Julie Brown, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. And again, her series, Perversion of Justice, received the George Polk Award earlier this year. She is being honored by Temple University, her alma mater, this week. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org, at WHYY Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Julie Brown, again talking about the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking operation, something that she uncovered as her worker, as a reporter for the Miami Herald. And for years, the billionaire was hiding essentially in plain sight, cavorting with some of the most powerful people in the world, amassing and creating a network of teenage girls for sex with himself and his wealthy friends. Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide earlier this year in August, the day after a cache of documents related to his case was unsealed. Let me talk a bit more about this. Virginia, is it Giuffre?
Giuffre,
who you describe as the most persistent accuser in this whole case. There was a lawsuit that was settled in 2017, and it seems like in this cache of documents, there was a lot about her and her allegations. What makes her so credible?
Well, I think for one thing, she has sued Epstein. She sued Maxwell. She has money, essentially, because she successfully sued them. She has no advantage at this point, really, to keep being out there in front of this and being, quite frankly, bullied by a lot of powerful people. So despite the fact that she could have just taken her lawsuit settlements and gone home to her kids and her husband in Australia and not had to face this kind of pressure and bullying that she's had, you know, there's just you know, I've done this for 30 years and you kind of get a feeling whether someone's credible or not, just based on how they present themselves, number one. Also, a lot of what she has said has been corroborated. You know, there have been plane logs, for example, that show she was on that plane at certain times. There are other pieces of evidence. There's a video that recently came out that shows her at a nightclub with Epstein and with Ghislaine Maxwell. Her most credible allegation thus far has been with Prince Andrew, because she actually has a photograph of the two of them together with Maxwell in the background. And so there are other things. She also has presented photographs of her at Epstein's ranch. So there's other things that corroborate the things that she has said.
Now, it should be said that Prince Andrew vehemently denies any kind of sexual contact with her. And Alan Dershowitz has said the same. George Mitchell has said the same. Yeah. Richardson of New Mexico. Bill Richardson has said the same. So she has accused very high-profile people, and they have said either it did not occur or I have never met this woman.
Right.
How do we sift through that?
Well, I don't know. I think that that's the job of law enforcement authorities. Hopefully that they'll dig into that. I don't know whether they're going to have the political will to do that, because these are some very powerful men. And, you know, this is also to some degree a he said, she said. You don't – when someone is sexually abused, you know, there isn't a whole lot of evidence. It's two people in the room. Now, it's possible that Epstein had you know, Virginia has said that he had his New York mansion wired with cameras all over the place. So it's possible that there's some videos out there. We just don't know yet.
He owned, when he was alive, a 10,000-acre ranch in New Mexico. One or maybe two private islands?
Yeah, two islands.
Two islands. He had a jet. Mm-hmm. He had a $13 million home in Palm Beach. He had a mansion in New York. I'm not sure what it's valued at. Do we know the value of his estate?
I think about $500 million, right. I think, about that.
And how did he make all this money? Because he...
Well, that's something I think a lot of reporters, and I'm sure the authorities, are sifting through now. We just did a story just recently about how he obtained that second island, and it was really through a straw buyer that happened to be a Dubai businessman who says he had no knowledge that he was being used as a straw buyer. You know, everybody now says, I didn't know him. I didn't know who he was. Everybody's trying to distance themselves from it and saying, I didn't know. I didn't know that this guy, you know, was, you know, all you have to do is Google his name. You had to know that he was accused of molesting underage girls. So it's pretty interesting how everyone is now saying that they didn't know anything. But as far as this money, I think that it's still unknown or unclear exactly how he made all his money.
Bill Clinton is also implicated, at least having flown with him on his jet. And I believe this was related to the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
Is there anything nefarious about that we should at least contemplate?
We don't have anybody saying that he was involved with these women. But, you know, as the women have pointed out to me in a couple of the stories I've written, you know, they contend that there is really nobody who hung around Epstein for any length of time who could not have known that he was doing something like this or doing something. The women that were involved, you know, even the ones that were of age but barely out of their teenage years, said that they were treated like almost like slaves. In other words, you go to a party, you see a row of women dressed scantily clad. They're not allowed to talk. They're all sitting there at a party and they're all just smiling. I mean, it doesn't feel right. Any human being would look at these girls and these women and say, this seems very weird, you know?
Well, in fact, President Trump said when he was a businessman, I believe it was a party at, or referencing the young women or girls that were hanging around with Jeffrey Epstein, that he seemed to, I'm paraphrasing here, you know, seemed to favor like
young girls.
Young girls. Mean, it was that obvious.
I think, like I said, the women themselves feel, you know, they have said to me, they knew. All these people who hung around him, they knew. You know, they just looked the other way and just felt like, I guess they're getting money, so it's okay because it's, you know, consensual. But in reality, some of them really were kept prisoner to some degree.
I've seen and I've watched some of them speak about what happened to them. They're eloquent. You know, they seem in certain ways sort of well put together. But I'm sure when talking with you and others that that is more a front than a reality. Can we think? I mean, they can think of themselves as victims or survivors or casualties. How do they think of themselves?
I think it depends on the woman. You know, some of them didn't fare well. Two of them are dead. One of them died of an opioid overdose right as I was starting my series, and she had a little boy. Most of them, if you look at their backgrounds, most of them have had drug problems. You know, many of them, some of them had been in prison. Courtney Wilde, the woman that brought the lawsuit, the crime victims rights lawsuit, she served longer in a state prison in Florida for on a drug charge than Epstein served for molesting, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of women. And so it's just the imbalance in our criminal justice system between the poor and the wealthy is just shameful, really.
Well, I mean, this uncovers so many things, including what you just said there, which that if you're wealthy, if you're well connected, if you know powerful people, if you can game the system, you're gonna pay a light sentence, if a sentence at all. And I think this case underscores that, and what you just said underscores that even more.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so important to understand, so revealing and so shocking at the same time.
Yeah, and you know, we have to see if there's going to be any kind of political will to change that. You know, I don't see it. I haven't seen anything happening under this administration to change that. There are a lot of people, by the way, on both sides of the political spectrum who believe that we need some kind of meaningful criminal justice reform in this country. But I don't see anybody really stepping up and changing anything.
What would criminal justice for these women, what would that be? Well, especially since Epstein is dead.
I think that they should. I think that they want restitution. I think they should get restitution. I think they have a lot of questions that they need to have answered, and I think they should be allowed to see the files. I think someone in Congress or a group of people in Congress should demand that they open that file and show them what the FBI knew when they knew it, so to speak. I think that they should, you know, follow the money and find out who these other people were that helped him, and they should be held accountable.
An email from Cameron. Will any of the powerful figures implicated in this case face justice or have their deeds put into the public? And I think you just answered that, which is just, is there a will in Congress, as you read it, to open this up for more scrutiny?
I think there is somewhat, but, you know, there is so much chaos right now in the White House that I think that the people in Congress who, you know, who would normally have pushed for this are completely overwhelmed. Mm. You know, it's this is like falling down among their priorities pretty far at this point. So it's kind of disheartening for these victims to see that happening.
Kevin asks, can your guests address the temple structure that was found on one of the islands?
I was told it wasn't really a temple structure. What it was he was building a library and he hired some kind of an architect to make it look like that. But he wanted it to be a library slash like music room conservatory kind of building. At the time that he was arrested again, he was really using it. I spoke to a couple people from the island. He was really using it for storage.
Wow.
So there's a lot of conspiracy theories around it because it is a bizarre looking structure.
Let me ask you about, this is a defamation suit in Manhattan. Alan Dershowitz, we mentioned earlier, has Giffray.
Yeah, Virginia.
Virginia are again back in court. What's at issue here?
Well, he, you know, when I did my piece, Perversion of Justice, As I said, my story was focused on the criminal justice system. I didn't really think about the fact that we knew that we were going to have to mention Mr. Dershowitz because Virginia had publicly come out and accused him and the prince of crimes, really, of having sex with her. So we mentioned it, but the focus of the story was not him. It was on the prosecutors and the lawyers that Epstein hired. But Mr. Dershowitz came out with all his guns and wanted to just go out there and, you know, go after me, go after Virginia, go after anybody. You know, his MO is to really bully people very, very hard. And you know, he did it so much that it got to the point that Virginia and her lawyer, David Boies, said, you know, he can't just keep going out there and calling. I mean, he was calling her a bad mother. He was calling her basically a whore. You know, he was saying a liar. He was saying that Mr. Boies, her lawyer, had concocted this whole story as part of an extortion plot. So finally, Virginia and I'm sure Mr. Boies, who has been representing her pro bono, just said, that's enough. We're going to sue you.
Defamation suit, right?
Right, and he was inviting it. Dershowitz was going out in front of the cameras, you know, almost every day and saying, I hope she sues me because then I'll be vindicated. I can prove in court then. And then as soon as she filed the suit, he filed a motion to dismiss it. So, and he changed gears and said, well, I had my free speech rights to say whatever I did. So it's very messy. He is a master at using the media. He really is. And I have to be very careful not to fall down the Dershowitz trap because you could spend your whole career defending or trying to defend against Dershowitz. And I really don't care to do that because I think it's a smokescreen to what the real story is, which is the imbalance in our criminal justice system against poor and wealthy people and women, young, vulnerable women, and how they're also not treated well in our criminal justice system. So I try to, you know, stay out of his sights.
A couple of minutes before I have to say goodbye, how did you end up at Temple University?
Well, at the time, you know, I was an emancipator. You know, I had been on my own for a while, and I didn't have any money. And so I applied for aid, and thankfully they gave me the money for the school. It was every day, every semester that went by, I kept praying that I was going to get that money. My best friend, I think, at the school was the financial aid counselor because I never thought I wondered if I would be back. And, you know, I'm eternally, forever grateful to Temple. There were great professors there. It's a great school, and I get very emotional talking about it because if it wasn't for them, I probably wouldn't be where I am right now.
Really? In terms of how you're able to create this career for yourself in journalism?
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned earlier that in many ways you identified with these young women who were on their own and adrift and at risk.
Yeah, and I was fortunate, but it was hard, you know, going through school on my own and commuting. I didn't live on campus. I had to commute every day. I started out at the Ambler campus. I had a professor that had me intern at the Pottstown Mercury, and, you know, that was when I realized I thought I would be practical and go into public relations because it had taken me 4 years to get to college, and I thought, you can't make any money as a journalist, so I better go into some kind of business-related journalism.
Nothing like following your own advice, right?
Yeah, but I couldn't do it. I didn't like public relations. I started writing for newspapers, and I loved it. So, you know, I did what I had to do, worked, you know, odd jobs on the side and waitressed on the side in order to get ahead in journalism.
Well, I'm glad you did what you did, and Julie Brown, I'm glad you joined us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having
such
me.
An important story. And again, Julie Brown, our guest, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Her series, Perversion of Justice with Emily Michaud, is about the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking of underage girls, his plea deal with U.S. prosecutors, won a number of awards, including the George Polk Award. She is the executive producer of a new podcast about the case. It's called Broken, produced with Adam McKay. And again, she's being honored by Temple University this week. Thanks for joining us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.